You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Hello and welcome to Stick Together, Australia's only national radio show dedicated to union news, workers' struggle and social justice. You're listening on 3CR Community Radio, broadcast from NAM Melbourne and across the country through the Community Radio Network. Before we begin, I want to acknowledge that this program is being broadcast from the lands of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respect to the Elders past and present. Extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners, wherever you're tuning in from today. Stick Together is brought to you with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We thank them for their ongoing support that makes the show happen. And today we've got a packed show, union news from across the country, as we take a look at some of the union issues that are going to be shaping up the year of 2026. And we're going to take a little bit of a deep dive into Venezuela and the ongoing role of US imperialism in the region. Now let's hear some union news.
3CR, always bringing you the latest union news.
They're coming after us at the moment. They want to get rid of penalty rates, the big push from businesses. They want to get rid of all the things that you and I have fought for.
So there's tens of thousands of jobs gone, contracted out. Sham contracting arrangement.
As the new year has just kicked off, it's clear 2026 is shaping up to be a major year of industrial struggle. Much as what has been laid out, some of the big stories to watch are the Transport Workers Unions, Our Roads, Our Skies, Our Future campaign. After nearly a decade of strategic organising, the TWU has aligned the expiry dates of around 200 enterprise agreements, covering an estimated 60,000 workers, that opens the door to coordinated, protected industrial action across aviation and transport. From Virgin, Qantas to Amazon, Toll, Linfox and Cleanaway. In a system designed to fragment workers' power, this kind of sector-wide strategy could be a game-changer for the industry. In Tasmania, public sector workers are already in motion, with health workers, teachers and public servants having been taking sustained industrial action against a take-it-or-leave-it offer from the Rockliffe government. At the heart of the fight are wages, workloads and a growing staffing crisis. With nurses and midwives entering an EBA year, this dispute is far from over. They're also signs of renewed organising strength in places long written off by the bosses. In the Pilbara, the Western Mine Workers Alliance has grown to over 5,000 members, recovered more than $1 million in underpayments, and is continuing to slow hard work of rebuilding union presence in the mining industry. In Victoria, public school teachers are negotiating a new agreement after the previous one expired at the end of last year. Teachers are demanding a 35% over 3 years, alongside action on workload and class sizes. With severe staff shortages and an election year looming, the pressure is building on the Victorian government. Internal union democracy is also in focus, with the United Workers Union election set to take place amid deep tensions following sackings and votes of no confidence. While with the CFMEU are still under administration, questions are still being raised from rank-and-file power, union independence, and the future of militant organising in construction and mining. And across the board, from nurses in New South Wales awaiting a crucial special case decision to public servants in Victoria fighting job cuts, one thing is clear, workers are not backing down, and we'll be covering a lot of these stories throughout the year. If you're involved in any of these disputes or know any information about it, please feel free to get in touch and we would love to take a deeper dive into some of these actions over the coming year. Now, today's main conversation shifts our focus internationally, but the themes will feel familiar. Power, imperialism, resistance, and solidarity. We're going to be talking about Venezuela, Latin America, and the ongoing impact of the US intervention in the region, including the sanctions, political destabilization. This discussion comes at a crucial time, with the actions from the US government, led by President Donald Trump, kidnapping the Venezuelan president and leaving a destabilized country, with many wondering what lies next for Venezuelan people. To unpack what's been going on inside Venezuela and a little bit of the history of the country, I'm joined by two guests with some deep experience and great critical thinking on the subject. First up, Federico Fontes. Federico is the editor of Lynx, International Journal of Socialist Renewal, a longtime Latin American solidarity activist and a member of the Socialist Alliance. He's lived in Venezuela for several years, working as a researcher and correspondent for Green Left from Caracas during the first decade of the Bolivarian Revolution under Hugo Chavez. He brings both on-the-ground experience and a long view of the political political processes shaping Venezuela and the region today. Also joining us is Carlos Eduardo Morio. Carlos is a Venezuelan academic and anti-colonial activist based here in Melbourne, and he's part of the Green Institute. His work focuses on imperialism, colonialism, and global power, being an important voice challenging mainstream narratives about Latin America and the global south. Just before we head into that conversation, I just want to give a quick plug for an upcoming public meeting that's linked to the discussion that we're going to hear today. On Thursday, January 29, there'll be a public forum titled Venezuela and Latin America, Trump's War on Latin America. The meeting will feature both Federico and Carlos and will dig deeper into US intervention, regional resistance, and how movements here in Australia can stand in solidarity with the Venezuelan people and the broader Latin American left. That's on Thursday, January 29 from 6:30 p.m. with dinner available from 6. Venue is yet to be announced, but if you check out Socialist Alliance, Green Left, LazNet, and many other places, I'm sure you'll be able to find the further details of that event. And I guess I should just let you know that this episode, there's actually going to be a longer version of the interview, which you'll be able to hear on the podcast. So if you're listening to today's show on the air and you want to hear a little bit more, just check out the podcast and you'll be able to hear the rest of that interview. So you're listening to Stick Together. I'm James Brennan, and this is my conversation with Federico and Carlos on Venezuela. Okay, everyone, thanks for joining us on Stick Together. Lucky enough to have Carlos and Federico join us to talk about what's happening in Venezuela at the moment. I'm sure a lot of listeners have been following the situation for Venezuelan people. You know, what this kind of means for Venezuela, you know, I guess the broader kind of Americas as well. And I think we want to start by some of the things that I think a lot of the media kind of missed is, you know, what's kind of led up to the situation that we see in Venezuela? You know, what did the Venezuelan Revolution kind of look like, maybe is a good way to kind of start. You know, what kind of characteristics did that take before we kind of get into the kind of things that have unfolded since then?
Fred, you, me.
I think it'd be good if you do, Carlos, as Venezuelan.
Sure, go for it. Thank you. Okay, so you know, as Fred just mentioned, you know, I am Venezuelan, right? I do think that matters a little bit in this discussion. Maybe I'll touch on to that. I'll touch on that a little bit later, you know, at some moment in the conversation. But James, okay, so your two kind of questions there. How did we get here? And something about the Bolivarian Revolution itself, its significance. Okay, well, I mean, I'm sure most listeners, you know, would know, and, you know, most people on the left, of course, know that the Revolución Bolivariana, the Bolivarian Revolution, was a significant kind of project led by Hugo Rafael Chavez Frias, led by Chavez, from 1999 onwards, when Chavez won a democratic election in Venezuela. Of course, before that, Chavez had already kind of announced himself in the early 90s through a failed coup against a kind of a political system and an economic system that was really sort of in crisis in Venezuela. You know, these were the years of neoliberalism, the late 80s, early 90s, where the oil industry had been kind of reprivatized and where there was extensive poverty, extreme poverty in the country. And the Bolivarian Revolution kind of arrives with a figure like Chavez, a charismatic figure, somebody, you know, from, you know, quite different to the kind of elite politicians in the country, and also coming from the military. And with a leftist background, Chavez puts forward essentially a project of kind of like national refoundation, like reestablishing the republic. We're going to have a new constitution drafted in those early years, 1999. And then the country now becomes the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, as opposed to just Venezuela. And a new democratic or radical democratic promise is put forward as well. The language in those early years is of participatory democracy. And the language of socialism, for example, is not quite there in those early years. It's a little bit later that the sort of the project takes on a socialist orientation or starts to speak the language of socialism. In those early years, it's participatory democracy, democracia participativa y popular, so popular and participatory democracy, and renationalization of the oil industry, sort of, you know, against kind of the neoliberal takeover, and also a kind of, you know, reestablishing the republic in line with the heritage of Simon Bolivar, now read as a, in sort of left
popular key.
Creating the kind of redistribution and wealth needed to be able to then move towards the kind of socialist project within Venezuela.
A little bit explained to how we got to where we are today really is the question of sovereignty and how that's envisaged by Chavez and in the national constitution. And that being that sovereignty is not simply a question of borders, but of this understanding that ultimate sovereignty lies within the people. And that's a real central part of Chavez's political thinking. You know, it's the other, you know, popular slogan that he raised, you know, was the idea of that you can only get rid of poverty by giving power to the people. You know, so this question of empowering people is central. And then expresses itself in two important ways. The first is the expansion of democracy. And that goes beyond just elections, although it includes elections. I mean, under Chavez, you know, Venezuela broke records for the amount of elections it had. It had elections at all levels. It had recall referendums. It had referendums to change the constitution. So, you know, that was part of it. But it went beyond that in terms of, you know, finding ways to allow communities and workers to start to empower themselves and take control over local decision-making, whether that be for cooperatives or running of factories, or whether that be through local communal councils to make decisions over how resources should be redistributed amongst citizens, amongst residents. And another important aspect of the sovereignty is, of course, reasserting sovereignty over natural resources. And of course, oil here is so key, with Venezuela being, you know, with the largest proven oil reserves in the world. So you can imagine, therefore, a project that's, you know, fundamentally premised on a radical idea of democracy, of which elections are a big part of, but it goes beyond that, and which wants to reassert control over natural resources, in particular a resource so important such as oil, so close to the United States, for the purpose of redistributing the wealth from that sector to help reduce the poverty of the majority, is a political project that, of course, is always going to come in the sights of U.S. governments. And that's really has been the case all along, essentially pretty much from when Chavez was elected, of course, right up until what we're seeing today with the kidnapping of the current president, Nicolas Maduro. Of course, that's one side of the equation. I mean, you know, I think also to understand where we get to today is how the US, through blockade of Venezuela, through its large raging sanctions on Venezuela that have been going on for almost over a decade now, how the right-wing opposition, who have consistently sought to undermine that democratic project in Venezuela, sought to subvert the order there and to undemocratically overthrow previously Chavez and then later Maduro. And I think also the actions of the Maduro government itself have led to a gradual undermining of that sovereignty. And that also is part of the picture to help us explain where we get to with January 3 and the reaction that we see after the US kidnapping of President Nicolas Maduro and Celia Flores, commonly just referred to as his wife, but who was also a very important political figure in Venezuelan politics, including previously as the president of the National Assembly.
You know, what lessons, I guess, are to be learned for socialists, you know, both in Venezuela trying to organize and outside about the limitations of countries that are capitalist countries that are going to impose sanctions on a left-wing socialist country, and then kind of internal issues of maybe not being able to have as deeper kind of structures of workers' co-ops and things like that as you had planned?
Yeah, look, I think there's two fundamental lessons that I think can be drawn. I mean, there's lots, but I would just focus here on two. I mean, I think the first is that, you know, what Venezuela shows is that any attempt at any kind of social change is obviously going to provoke a reaction. It's going to provoke a reaction from foreign countries, imperialist, in particular countries from the global north, like the United States and others as well, Australia, of course, being part of that global north, countries that for a long time have benefited from stealing the wealth of countries from the global south. And there's perhaps no clearer picture than that of the oil wealth that's been stolen from Venezuela for many decades, going primarily to the United States. It's obviously going to provoke a reaction there and a reaction from the economic elites. And that is definitely an important part of understanding how we get to where we are today, because it is absolutely fair to say That the right-wing opposition, beginning with, you know, it should be mentioned, Maria Corina Machado, who, you know, obviously has gained a lot of international recognition following her the awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize to her. But he's someone who, for, you know, two decades has actively sought and actively operated outside of the law in Venezuela, seeking to go against the will of the people in elections after elections, where first Chavez won, and then certainly in the earlier period of the Maduro government, where Maduro did also win elections. So that's definitely the first lesson, that those challenges will always be there. But I think the second lesson, and this was a critical part of really Chavez's project and the lesson he tried to impart, was that the only way ultimately that you can defeat that, the only way you can be able to get through that, is by, you know, convincing the broadest possible number of people seeking to win a social majority to your project. And that's what he constantly did. You know, I always think about that. A really good example was the recall referendum that I mentioned before, which of Maria Corina Machado played a really important role in collecting the signatures for that referendum. Now, at that time, there was a dispute as to whether enough signatures had actually been collected to go to a recall referendum or not. And the polls were indicating that it was likely that Chavez would lose such a referendum if it was to go ahead. And so there were sections within the government that were encouraging Chavez to just simply dismiss it, to just say, well, look, you know, they don't have the signatures. We don't need to do this recall referendum. Let's just ignore it. But Chavez took the opposite approach. He saw this as a political challenge to actually try to win the majority, even though he knew he was starting from behind, but to win them over to vote for his political project. And so he said, look, you don't have the signatures, but I'm going to let you go ahead with this recall referendum, and I'm going to win. And he won with a bigger majority than what he'd won his presidential election. So that was a key part of his lesson. Unfortunately, we can't really say the same, you know, in the later period of the Maduro government, you know, where we see, for example, the quite heavily disputed 2024 presidential elections, where we still to this day do not know who won those elections, because the National Electoral Council and the government have refused to publish any of the results from that election to be able to verify what had happened. So we do, I think that's the second part, is that, yes, there will be powerful enemies that try to confront such projects for change, but we also have choices that we make, decisions that we take. And those choices can be premised on the idea of seeking to win people to your project, or of simply seeking to keep power for the sake of keeping power. And I think, unfortunately, in the Venezuelan process over the last 25 years, we've seen certainly a mixed balance sheet on that second question, particularly, I would say, under the Maduro government.
I mean, we must make a distinction, really, between those early years of Chavez, you know, from 1999 till 2013, when Hugo Chavez, you know, dies in early 2013, March 2013, and then the government that comes after that, which is a government of Nicolas Maduro from, you know, 2013 up until now, you know. So we have 13 or 14 years of Chavez first, and then we have another, you know, 13 years of Maduro, right? So you can pretty much split the Venezuelan process, you know, what some still term the Bolivarian Revolution, though I would kind of keep the term for the earlier years, into these two moments. And as Fred was saying, Chavez was, you know, one of the remarkable things about Chavez, you know, there are some moments when, you know, you might question a decision here and there, and the way he approached some these questions of kind of democratic legitimacy, etc. But Chavez, on the whole, consistently backed popular mobilization, and he approached elections and, you know, the many elections that we had throughout his 13 years in government. He approached these elections as opportunities to discuss what the country was facing, discuss kind of the orientation of the revolutionary process, and mobilize the popular masses, you know, mobilize, you know, las clases populares and working class communities throughout the country. This, you know, so we would have, you know, you know, there were years where there were, you know, two, three elections, and, you know, he approached these as kind of massive campaigns to kind of educate the populace, but also as victories to celebrate, you know, as victories to celebrate. And it's such a contrast. I mean, the contrast between how Chavez approached this, you know, his commitment to these, you know, as I said, to this kind of popular mobilization and winning on the democratic ledger, with the kind of more autocratic or authoritarian kind of logics that we see developing later with Maduro, is a serious contrast. And I do think that this is a lesson to underscore, and something for the left to appreciate and to sort of take on board on board in the different forms of critical solidarity that we might want to engage with, you know, with projects and processes in Latin America and elsewhere, but also with the kinds of politics that we want to develop here, you know, in so-called Australia. So, you know, very much agreeing with Fred there and kind of underscoring that distinction between the way in which Chavez approached this and then Maduro later. But let me just add one more thing, just kind of coming back to the oil side and kind of left politics in Venezuela. So, I mean, the development, like the capitalist development and development in Venezuela, largely a matter of, you know, kind of a dependent development, you know, a sort of as an oil producing country, as an oil exporting country, you know, Venezuela kind of enters kind of contemporary, you know, modern capitalism in the early 20th century, 1910, 1920, basically as an oil exporter with a dictatorship back then, with a military dictatorship, you know, dictatorial government in the 20s and 30s, and essentially servicing the capitalist needs and the energy needs of North America, right? Of the US. Funnily enough, you know, the kind of scenario that Trump is putting forward for Venezuela today is reminiscent of the situation the country was in a century ago, where essentially you had back then, you know, Royal Dutch Shell and Standard Oil, which today is Exxon, and a few others, essentially controlling oil production in Venezuela, and in a sense, developing the state in a way that was conducive to oil extraction and oil resources and oil wealth going to the north. And the Trump's gamble, what some conservative political scientists are referring to as the coercive accountability that Trump is sort of putting forward right now, is in a sense trying to sort of bring Venezuela back to that early 20th century scenario. So staying with the 20th century, what did the left do? What did the Communist Party do? What did socialists did? What did unions and those on the side of workers' politics do throughout the 20th century? Well, we tried to develop a left politics around you know, oil sovereignty, around the control of oil production, and the popular and kind of democratic distribution of oil resources and throughout the 20th century. So you can basically read Venezuelan history as the effort from different paths, different factions, and different groups, and trying to sort of gain control for the country, you know, sovereign control of oil resources, which, you know, you have a key moment in the 1970s, and then the second key moment is, of course, the early years of the Bolivarian Revolution with Hugo Chavez. And the aim there is then to use oil resources to, you know, to further development or use oil wealth to empower or to facilitate some kind of transformation, and to spend these oil resources in ways that benefit the mass of the population that had been somehow excluded from earlier oil rent redistribution. And we're talking about very significant, you know, size, you know, very significant, you know, very significant numbers here, right? So during the early years of Chavez, you know, from 1999 up until about 2014, Venezuela is producing close to 3 million barrels of oil per day. You know, the figures start to drop a little bit around 2010. So, but you know, one of the things that the government kind of is committed to in the early years is essentially taking the resources gained from the selling of this oil and kind of spending it, you know, through social spending, the you know, the so-called social missions, literacy programs, the Cuban doctors and kind of the hospitals in the poorer parts of the city, you know, parts of the country that had sort of been kind of excluded from the earlier political system. I mean, this is all very significant, and this is a kind of a unique project that Chavez developed, but that had sort of earlier versions you could sort of see in the 1970s as well, you know, with the project of once again kind of redistributing oil wealth. There's a downside to this, you know, there's a huge downside to this. There's sort of a problematic structure with this economy, which is that the oil resources, the redistribution of oil resources, well, in a way, I mean, not so much the redistribution of oil resources, but the you know, have the country with the coming in of this money, kind of in a way, if the aim is somehow to sort of move into a different kind of development, bring about a development beyond the dependency on this on the sole export of oil for the development of the country, in a way, your dependency on oil in a way kind of sticks you in this sort of structural situation situation that is very hard to escape. And we saw this in the 1970s. We couldn't do it back then. And Chavez tried to do this, but in a sense made the country even more dependent on oil export and oil revenues. And of course, later on with the oil sanctions, the country, the economy starts to unravel, and given the dependency on oil revenue revenue earned from oil exports.
I want to kind of fast forward a little bit now. I know there's so much that we could continue to kind of unravel about all of that period. And I think it's really important to get to the next for us to understand, the kind of current situation as well. But I guess thinking about, what is the current situation, with Maduro being, kidnapped out of Venezuela, the US essentially taking control of the country. I think for those that, have lived as part of the kind of, even you're talking about a big history there of, of Venezuela and, oil and imperialism in the region and things, but even, more recently, obviously, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, like all of these places have been places that the US has either, attempted to or wanted to kind of take over because of oil reserves and resources, that it's difficult to imagine people believing anything the US says about why they're going to take over or invade a country. I wonder if start by kind of talking a little bit now about, I guess, what kind of sense do you get about the impact in Venezuela for Venezuelan people? And I guess, for those outside of Venezuela like ourselves, what can we kind of do to show solidarity for the people there?
Let me maybe jump in. I mean, the situation in Venezuela has been very, very difficult for ordinary Venezuelans for several years, right? And so I don't want to rewind too much, because I know you want us to talk about the current situation, but just need to highlight one or two things, right? So I mean, the situation has been very difficult in Venezuela. So minimum wages in Venezuela have sort of right now, is depending on how you measure it, is around $120 or so, and much of that is really sort of bonuses that the state pays people rather than actual salary, actually wages, that have very little sort of, that don't count for superannuation and things like that. Of course, we had a few years ago, we had the massive exodus of Venezuelans. You probably heard the figure, 7 million Venezuelans left the country between 2016 and 2020. And partly as a result of the crisis, but also, partly as a result of the sanctions, and what that did to the oil industry, but also partly as a result of, poor sort of economic and policy choices from Maduro and to some degree Chavez as well. So the situation has been very difficult in Venezuela for the last couple of years. And then this was totally, this was very much something that was kind of used by the opposition, and also used by, the US president, this buffoon they have, this President Donald Trump, kind of, seek to then undermine to use the situation, against the country, or to use it in their, to use it to their benefit in some way or another. What are we facing right now? I've been having conversations with friends, peers on the left in Venezuela, and some are more hopeful and others are kind of confused and worried about what they're facing right now and what's happening within the government and how the government is sort of positioning itself in relation to Trump. But let me say that just want to kind of underscore something here as well, kind of really emphasize something here. What happened on Saturday the 3rd of January, of course, was an imperialist aggression. It was an attack against sovereignty, against self-determination. So we need to sort of denounce that. And there's simply no way in which this can be justified. And, a second ago, when you were kind of when you were sort of introducing this segment, putting forward your question, you were saying that people don't trust the US. And of course, there's plenty of reason not to trust the arguments put forward by Trump or by the US government, right? So, with Iraq, there was weapons of mass destruction. With Venezuela, the argument that the US was peddling there was narco-terrorism, and as an accusation, and the whole discourse of doing something about the war on drugs, that has largely been a language, a discourse that the US has used to sort of intervene and kind of govern what they consider to be kind of unruly state in the region, or ways to sort of intervene and kind of work against and communities and the people in the region.
Yeah, look, I'll jump in just quickly. I recognize that time's running short for this interview. I would just really quickly say three things. The first is that the world is a much more dangerous place after January 3. The actions that the US have done in Venezuela are not just a direct threat to the people of Venezuela, not even just a direct threat to the people of Latin America, but really have set an extremely dangerous precedent for where we're heading. You know, not just the action itself, but the open discourse of saying that from now on, might is right. What benefits the US is what will happen, and what will determine what occurs around the world. So, I mean, that's absolutely the first thing that has to be said. The second thing, going back to a point that I made earlier on this question of sovereignty, I agree with much of what Carlos just said there, that what we've had over the past few years is that gradual undermining of that popular sovereignty that was so much at the heart of the Bolivarian Revolution, so much at the heart of Chavez's revolution, that idea that ultimate power resides in the people. And instead, we've seen that power very much, you know, being centered in the state and the government as opposed to the people. But I think after January 3, we don't even have that anymore. We have an even loss of just actual national sovereignty, where now decisions are being made not in Caracas, but in Washington. And that's very clear with all the immediate actions we've seen since January 3, the reestablishment or the moves towards reestablishing the US embassy in Caracas, the US government working in collaboration with the Venezuelan government to return oil tankers with so-called sanctioned oil to bring them back to Venezuela, with the US essentially determining, you know, where and how oil production will occur and where the sales will occur. So this is a really, really dangerous, like really bad situation that we're in, where essentially Venezuela is returning, you know, to a kind of a colonial, you know, a real colonial status. So it's something that really needs to oppose. So then the third thing I would say is that's why I think it is really important that we speak out about what's going on. And I think that has to be done on two levels. I think the first is, of course, is that, you know, no matter what we may or may not think of Nicolas Maduro and Celia Flores, they need to be immediately released and returned to Venezuela. Any crime that they may or may not have done, it's up for the Venezuelan people to determine that. And then in no way can the US set itself up as the judge, jury and executioner for people from other countries. But our response, I don't think, can be limited to just that as well, because as I said, there are much deeper things happening right now in Venezuela in terms of the real loss of sovereignty. And I think that's where it's so important for us to listen to voices from the progressive left, from the trade unions in Venezuela, the voices that none of the other media really covers, who are much more interested in just hearing Trump, the government, or Machado. One would think they're the only free political factors in Venezuelan politics, when in fact most of the polls show that most Venezuelans support none of those. Their favorite option is none of the above. Well, we should try to be able to get those voices out and see how we can support them in their struggles for restoration of their rights for democracy, because as much as everyone talked about Venezuelan democracy before, that's one thing that really no one is talking about now in Venezuela today. Well, what's going to happen in terms of real democracy in Venezuela? And we can rest assured that that's the least of the interest of the political class in Washington or also in Caracas as well today.
Thanks so much to both of you. And that brings us to the end of today's episode of Stick Together. A big thank you to my guests Federico and Carlos for joining us and sharing their insights on Venezuela, Latin America, and the ongoing impacts of imperialism and the region, and what we can do to show solidarity with all the people there in Venezuela. Thanks as well to everyone involved in putting together today's program, the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We thank them for the ongoing support. And this show exists because workers organize on the job and we love to report on the things happening in your workplace. So if you have a story or you're involved in a campaign or anything like that that you'd like to get in contact with us, you can at sticktogether3cr@gmail.com, and we'd love to cover your story. If you missed any part of today's program or you want to share it with your workmates, you can listen back at Stick Together via the 3CR website. And like I said at the start of the show, there is a longer version of this show on the podcast. So either on the 3CR website or wherever you normally listen to podcasts, you can listen to an extended version of this episode or listen back to any other episodes. And just a reminder of the upcoming public meeting, Venezuela and Latin America, Trump's War on Latin America, happening in Melbourne on Thursday, January 29 from 6:30 p.m. I'm James Brennan. You'll be listening to Stick Together on 3CR Community Radio and across the Community Radio Network. We'll leave you today with a song, In Venezuela by David Rovix. And remember, wherever you are, whatever you do, there's a union for you. Until next time, stick together.
Chavez was elected, like every time he ran. When his socialists took power, that's when the changes began. The opposition started attacking every forward move, but reforms went ahead, the people's welfare improved. A land of such riches that had always gone to so few was reaching places ignored since 1492 in Venezuela. Millions poured into the streets to stop the coup back then. They got the man that they elected back into power again. The Bolivarian Revolution became famous worldwide. Soon other socialist governments swept in a red tide. Between the Cuban doctors and the Venezuelan oil, millions got medical care, millions tilled the soil of Venezuela. Began the sanctions, Obama imposed more, a slow-burning, destabilizing economic war. Following the formula of the Chicago Boys team, used in many places to make economies scream. Oil prices plummeted, foreign holdings locked, invasions being planned, negotiations blocked in Venezuela. Haitian Revolution to Venezuela today, from the Seminoles to Salvador Allende. Look at their ankles, you'll see the chains, imperial vampires, open veins, those who stand up to the business elite, who cannot stand to see the workers in the driver's seat in Venezuela. In Venezuela.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.